With last weekend's release of Man of Steel, the big-budget revival of the Superman story, and its earnings of $125 million those 3 days, the summer movie season is in full swing. I'm Jeff Bossert. This morning on Focus, we'll get an idea of what's worth seeing and what isn't in a time of Hollywood blockbusters and smaller films. We'll be joined by Matt Zoller-Seitz, the new editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com, a website that includes not only new movie reviews, but boasts of old essays from the Urbana native and late film critic, and blog posts from his wife, Chaz. We'll talk about some of Matt's favorite films of the year so far, but we'll also discuss his role with the website and how he recruits new talent with the same knack for writing as Roger Ebert. We'll also be joined by Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips for his take on the year in cinema so far in 2013. What are your recommendations, and what movies do you want to know more about? We're talking movies this morning on Focus. The conversation gets started after this hour's news. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm Jeff Bossert. If you followed box office numbers from Cineplexes this past weekend, you may have noticed the relaunch of the Superman story Man of Steel netted $125 million, approximately. Dominating the rest of the box office the last few weeks at movie theaters, films include This Is the End, an apocalyptic comedy, and comedies like The Internship, Hangover Part 3, and more sci-fi action, Star Trek Into Darkness. And children's animated features will no doubt be part of the box office picture in the coming weeks. Movies like Monsters University and Despicable Me 2 are opening soon. On today's program, we're talking summer movies and smaller films released in 2013. Joining us on the phone this morning is on Focus is Matt Zoller-Seitz. He's the new editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com. He's also a TV critic for New York Magazine and Vulture.com and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Criticism. Seitz has written, narrated, edited, or produced over 100 hours worth of video essays about cinema history and style for the Museum of the Moving Image and Elle Magazine, among other outlets. He's also the founder and original editor of The House Next Door, now part of Slant Magazine, and publisher of Press Play, a blog of TV and film criticism. He's also a filmmaker himself. Matt has also been a guest at the annual Ebert Fest in Champaign each spring, part of the panel and post-film discussions. We'll be joined in a bit by Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips as well to get his take on the year in film so far in 2013. Of course, we welcome your questions on Focus on Movies this morning. Phone numbers are 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or reach out to us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Matt Zoller-Seitz, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being part of the show. First, let's talk about, before we get into movies playing in the theaters right now, talk about your first contact with Roger Ebert and how that relationship developed.
Well, my first contact with Roger was when I interviewed him about, 14 or 15 years ago. This was the period when he had his TV show. It was still syndicated, but it was after Gene Siskel had died, and he was going through a rotating lineup of guests co-host to see who would be the permanent replacement, and finally it ended up being Richard Roper. And he was coming through New York, and I had dinner with him, and it was quite an interesting experience. It was a professional thing. I didn't know him at that point, but he was in an interesting place because he was very much aware of his own singularity as a critic, and part of the problem that he had was just finding somebody who could replicate that chemistry that he had with Gene Siskel. And, no offense to Richard Roper, who I like quite a bit, but I don't think anybody ever could, you know. I mean, there was something really special about those two guys. So I went several years without speaking to him. We were part of the National Film Critics Circle, and so we kind of communicated a little bit via email chains about various subjects that the group was discussing, like whether or not to give D.W. Griffith an award, things like that. And I finally did strike up an actual relationship with him about 5 or 6 years ago. I was publishing my blog, The House Next Door, which is now a part of Slant Magazine. And Roger was really intrigued by what I was doing there. It was a group-run blog. And at the time, the sort of default format for a blog was just one person's thoughts. And this was run more like a magazine. We edited the content. Everything went through two sets of hands before it saw publication, so there was a hopefully slightly higher quality level than you get where there's no oversight. And he liked that, and he actually adopted some of the things that we were doing at his own website. And, of course, Roger was an early adopter of that stuff. But our relationship was primarily one founded on our interest in finding and mentoring new talent. And Roger, of course, had been at it a lot longer than I had and had a much bigger reach. So it was kind of funny because what we would do is I would email him and say, hey, have you seen this blog post by this young critic out of Indiana? You should give her some work. And he would write back something like, I already know about her. I'm publishing her first piece on Friday. You know, it was almost like a comedy routine. He was usually two or three steps ahead of me, but once in a while I would send him somebody that he hadn't heard of, and sometimes they would end up being published on his site.
Well, it speaks to the level that Roger was involved in his last few years of his life when he sadly lost his voice and became such an advocate for social media, and he was always on Twitter and writing more reviews.
He was unbelievable in that way. He was really incredible. And when you think about this guy, for some reason, I mean, despite all of his other accomplishments as a critic and just as a human being, when people ask me, when you think of Roger Ebert, what do you think about? The first thing that comes to mind is the fact that this guy lost his jaw to cancer and then he wrote a cookbook. Isn't that amazing?
That's remarkable.
I think that's the best definition of defiance that I can think of, actually. It was just a wonderful book, too, like all of his stuff.
I want to mention yesterday would have been Roger's 71st birthday, one that he shares with Paul McCartney. And how do you think the world of film criticism is recovering from his loss?
Well, I think it's... I don't really know. I think we're too. I think it's too soon to properly answer that question. I know that we are still struggling to process it ourselves. When I say we, I mean me and Chaz Ebert and the folks over at Ebert Digital and Hank Sarton, who's my managing editor, who's formerly of Time Out Chicago. And that's really the big challenge for the website is finding a way to be true to the spirit of Roger Ebert without sort of trying to slavishly replicate whatever it was we think that he would have done or said, because I don't think he would have wanted that. In fact, I know he wouldn't have wanted that because he didn't surround himself with clones. He surrounded himself with idiosyncratic people who often disagreed with him about things. That he really enjoyed that. He loved conversation and combat. That's one of the reasons why he was friends with Gene Siskel for so long, even though they didn't always agree.
We'd love to hear from you if you have any questions about summer movies or the website RogerEbert.com. We're talking with Matt Zoller, Sites Editor-in-Chief of that website. Around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 or Outlying, 800-222-9455. You can also reach us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Matt, I'm wondering if there were particular Ebert reviews long ago that stood out for you and inspired you in the way you wrote them.
Well, a big one. I'll tell you, the biggest one is one that not a lot of people remember, I don't think, when they think of Roger. It was his review of a movie called Stormy Monday, which came out in 1988, and that starred Sean Bean, Melanie Griffith, and Tommy Lee Jones. It was directed by Mike Figgis, and it was a modern noir. And what Roger did was, this was a movie that was so purely driven by the visuals. It was all about the texture and the sort of the way that cigarette smoke curled and shafts of light coming through Venetian blinds and the sounds of car engines and gunshots and ice cubes dropping into glasses before they pour the liquor in, things like that. It was like a sensual movie. And what he did in this review was he barely described the plot. What it was a just series of terse lyrical descriptions of images, sounds, and sensations in the film. And that was a beautiful example of form following function. I can't think of a better way to communicate the essence of a movie, of what it's like to watch a particular movie, than to shape the review in a way that reflects it. And Roger was really an absolute master of that, of experimenting with form. He wrote a review of a Jim Jarmusch film. I'm trying to remember which one it was. I think it was the one, The Limits of Control. That's what it was. And it was all written from the point of view. It was sort of a fantasy of the leading man's mental state as he was shooting the movie. And you can see a lot of these kind of creative writing experimentations. And he was known as a master of the straightforward bread and butter review. That sort of communicated the essence of a film and whether or not you might find something in it that's to your liking. He was a great consumer guide, but he He was also a very fine writer who I think pushed the form of film criticism about as far as it could go while still being comfortable within the mainstream. And there's a kind of a genius to that, I think.
We should also note that RogerEbert.com includes a lot more than simply reviews.
Yeah, it does. And reviews are sort of the main part of the site. That's the reason I think a lot of people visit it. They want to see what's opening, what we thought of it, and how many stars it got. But it's also a film magazine, and we specialize in original content. And we really are priding ourselves on being more of a magazine-type operation. We don't do a lot of short blog posts that are basically aggregation. You know what I'm talking about, where it's so-and-so published an article about an article about an article, and here's our summary of it with a trailer attached. Like, we don't do that. We're trying to generate original content that has a point of view and maybe puts things in a slightly larger context, or at least has some entertainment value beyond just sort of rehashing what you've already seen on Twitter and Facebook.
Well,
that's kind of the goal.
You were officially announced, I think, early this month as the new editor of the site. How's that going so far? Trying to reach out to new talent and find people who can...
I am, actually. I'm not having any trouble doing that now because the reputation of the site is such that people are pitching a lot of articles and wanting to get involved, and I think that's wonderful. And it's a great mix of veterans that people who read a lot of film criticism and reportage have heard of, and some newcomers, people they've never heard of, and it's going to be quite nice. I've got a couple of pieces going up this week that I think people are going to enjoy. One of them on jerk behavior in movies, and how many of the summer movies are just sort of driven by jerks, just people who sort of strut around and give commands and act as if they're, well, the star of the movie, which they often are. That's something that's been bothering me as well, and I think a lot of people are going to enjoy that. And, of course, we had a lot of original pieces yesterday. I think 8 or 9 in total keyed into Roger's birthday and aspects of Roger's legacy, and I was quite proud of that. I really would recommend anybody who's a science fiction fan check out the site, because we published a previously unpublished piece by Roger, which is a science fiction story. As you probably know, Roger was a huge science fiction lover, and he had been since childhood, and he used to read Amazing Stories magazine and other anthologies and even write letters to them. And when he was in the hospital a few months ago, Chaz suggested that he try to keep his spirits up by writing something that was purely pleasurable, and he wrote a science fiction story, but he didn't finish it. So we're having a contest, a reader contest, to finish Roger's short story. And if you go on the site, you can see it. It's called the Thinking Molecules of Titan.
I've actually got that right in front of me. And want to point out that it's set in part on the University of Illinois campus.
It is indeed. It is indeed. And there's a wonderful piece of art on there by Krishna Bala Shenoy, who's a young illustrator and animator out of India, who is one of Roger's discoveries, I guess you'd say. And as you can see, he did a mock-up of an Amazing Stories magazine cover circa 1950s, which is really just wonderful.
Well, Chaz Ebert has had glowing rave reviews about you taking over in this position early this month. And I quote here, Matt mentored journalists, critics, and video essayists with a benevolent style that helped to bring out the best in what they did. Sound like someone we know?
That's awfully nice of her to say that. I think I appreciated that most of everything that she said. Chaz is a great lady. She really is, and she's extraordinary. When you look at the magnitude of what Roger stood for and the many different moving parts that are his legacy, and then you look at how gracefully and indefatigably she has conducted herself in this really, really difficult time, it's quite extraordinary. And it's something that I understand myself, having lost a spouse, and we've talked about that a lot. It's it's tough to put on a brave face under any circumstances, but when you are, in a sense, the spiritual heir to a tradition, which Chaz is, it's even tougher. And she's just really a great human being.
We'll bring in Michael Phillips here in just a moment for the conversation to talk about summer movies and the year in film so far. You can call us at 333-9455 or outlying area 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Matt, I have to mention, Chaz sort of calls you out, but in a nice way, that you gave a very positive review to After Earth, the sci-fi film with Will Smith and son Jaden that's been widely panned by critics and the public.
Yeah, well, they're all wrong. I knew that I was going to get in trouble for liking that movie so much, but that's fine. And when you look at the history of film criticism, there are many cases where a critic diverted rather drastically from whatever the consensus was, and it might have been something that was later proved wrong, such as Pauline Kael finding 2001 rather boring. That was pretty notorious among cinephiles, and Jonathan Rosenbaum, the Chicago Reader critic, treasured that ensemble film Bobby from a few years ago, which almost nobody liked. I think that might have even been his number one film of that year. It happens. And in fact, sometimes the critics are right to go against the herd. Sometimes they're wrong, but it's important to write what you feel. And I think that was a lovely, special, very sincere, widely misunderstood movie. It's essentially a film aimed at children and their parents. It's about the communication of values and a legacy, and it's told in very simple terms. And if it had been made in the 1950s, it might have starred Randolph Scott and Clint Walker and been set in the West. That's the sort of level that it's operating at. And I frankly think a lot of the criticisms against it are judging it on terms that it never wanted to be judged by and never intended to be judged by. It's like asking, where are the musical numbers? It's not that kind of a movie.
Well, and Chaz immediately points out you have the right to defend this movie and did a nice job of defending a film that's been
well,
and
oh, yeah.
Roger had a share of those as well.
Yeah, and of course she would say that because she used to be married to a guy who occasionally would love a film that everybody else hated or was indifferent to. And my favorite example of that was he picked another Mike Figgis film, The Loss of Sexual Innocence, which kind of came and went without a trace and was mostly panned as his number one film the year that it came out, 2000, I think it was. And Crash, well, it certainly has its defenders. There was an enormous pile-on by critics and a large part of the public when that movie looked like it was going to win the Oscar and finally did win the Oscar. Roger gave that 4 stars. And Roger has had a long history of writing whatever he felt to be true in his heart as a moviegoer and letting the chips fall where they were going to fall. And I think everybody who writes for the site has been encouraged to do that. And you're going to see some more surprises, and maybe we'll be proved right, maybe we'll be proved wrong, and maybe a simple right and wrong is not the way that we should be discussing entertainment and art. That's another thing that we should probably get into.
Well, welcome to the conversation, Michael Phillips, Chicago Tribune film critic. He's also has been one of the fill-in hosts during the program At the Movies in the program's final years, and like Matt, has been part of post-film discussions at EbertFest. Good morning, Michael.
How you doing, guys?
Good.
Hey, Michael.
Nice to
hey,
talk
Michael.
To you again.
Nice to talk to you.
Let's talk a bit about the summer movies. The big review, of course, on the RogerEbert.com website, giant picture, is Man of Steel. And I guess we'll start, Matt, with your reviews. I think you gave it 3 stars.
I did. I thought it was an excellent example of the kind of big-budget superhero movie that is being made right now in the early part of the 21st century, which is incredibly expensive, lots of destruction, somewhat downbeat, somewhat going for kind of a gritty or quote-unquote realistic attitude. It's not the Christopher Reeve Superman. It's just not. And I prefer the Christopher Reeve Superman for a lot of reasons, not just because it's, you know, I'm nostalgic for my childhood, which I think a lot of us are. I think there was something really, really lovely about those films, how sweet and generous and not interested in being cool and dark they were. And I don't think this new movie cares about that. But I do respect the fact that they're going in a different direction, that they're not just trying to replicate the Reeves Superman, which I think is part of the reason why Superman Returns from 6-7 years ago didn't do so well, that it was kind of a little too stuck in the past for most people, I think. But I did have a lot of problems with it, and particularly I didn't like the way that they had tried to butch up Superman so much. They, you know, not just the character, but the whole milieu to where I almost felt like parts of the film should have had a No Girls Allowed sign hanging on them. That bugged me.
And, yeah, Michael, we'll go ahead and talk about your review. I think you gave it half star or less.
Two and a half, yeah. Although I have to say, circumstances, i.e. my 12-year-old son wanted to go with two of his friends. I ended up seeing that one twice, after I saw it a second time after I wrote the review. And the review, and already the thing was sliding down to kind of a two for me. What you have in a case like this is a lot of different component parts, and the second time through, the sort of grotesque level of the destruction and the insanely misjudged, protracted, just sort of grinding duration of the two big fight sequences that are essentially the majority of the last 45, 50 minutes. To me, the second time through, that was almost hard. It was almost impossible to get through. And I find the film's not dismissible, and it's certainly not one of the worst things Zack Snyder's directed, but because he's made things I really detested, like Watchmen and Sucker Punch. But I think this guy is just not my kind of action director. He loves closely kind of confining, handheld, nausea-inducing camera work, and the blurrier the action, the better. And I know you always sound like a 90-year-old, silent movie fan when you talk like this. But it's just, to me, that's not good action aesthetics. And
I agree.
Yeah, you can say the same a lot about how J.J. Abrams deals with Star Trek Into Darkness. He loves a close camera. He loves, I don't think that's a fig. I mean, he does a wide variety of fixed and kind of handheld camera work, but he just knows how to kind of lay out an action sequence, and that's no minor skill, right, Matt?
No, it's not. In fact, I do feel that this is more than a fashion statement, this way of photographing action and this way of photographing story, because it's not just confined to action. Filmmaking, really great filmmaking, really true filmmaking to me, is one where the position of the camera is chosen for a particular reason, where the shot is that way for a reason, the camera moves that way for a reason, and when you just sort of stick the camera up in the actors' faces and shake it around a lot, I think what you're trying to do is, A, generate artificial excitement without putting thought into it, which is the equivalent of when you're writing, ending up every sentence in an exclamation point and putting it in boldface to make it more exciting. It's like, well, if you can't let the words do the work, I guess that's the next best thing.
But it sounds like you could be talking about Baz Luhrmann and Great Gatsby there.
Well, you kind of can, although the funny thing is, Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby has, I think, a lot more thought put into camera movement and composition than almost any of the big superhero movies this summer.
I disagree with almost every choice he makes, but there is some thought.
World War Z. World War Z, the action sequences in World War Z were for the most part done in that way as well, and I really am depressed when I see that, because it feels like it's a default mode of filmmaking. They're not directing, they're covering for the most part. And there are some films that I think are good films that are done in that style. Like, I thought the Bourne films were, for the most part, very, very good films. But at the same time, and again, I guess I do sound like a crotchety old dude, but would it have killed him to put it on a tripod once in a while?
No, I know.
Would it
I
have
know.
Made
you know
it
what? You know,
it,
you know why, man?
Would it destroy the film's integrity if he used a tripod once in a while?
Yeah. I've asked directors, why, what has happened to just the interest in holding, a figure blocking and then holding a shot for 5-8 seconds? I'm not talking about, a minute and a half Scorsese goes through the door of the Copa in Goodfellas, a really stunning single take sequence that's designed to show off. I'm just talking about kind of old fashioned, conventional, okay, let's figure out, these actors are here, somebody's going to enter the scene, and the camera's we're not going to cut, we're just going to simply pivot and include this third character, and the camera will move around in an interesting way. All that's gone, and a lot of it's just, a lot of it's blamed on time. We don't have the time to actually even rehearse or figure out on paper these setups. We have to just, we basically fix it in editing, and that, to me, that's why you get movies like this. And you're right, Matt, World War Z, which the review's, I think, going up later today or tomorrow. It's like Mark Forster, the director of that, and Zack Snyder, the director of Man of Steel, should just be gently guided into kind of a film, you know, re-education camp, you know, communist or otherwise, and just sort of be, you know, kind of encouraged to just figure out, okay, how do you map out a sequence that's going to hold a shot for just a simple shot, 8, 5, 10, 15 seconds?
Well, there are actually some directors who still know how to do that, and Spielberg is still one of the absolute masters of that, although his camera has gotten a lot more nimble and sort of loose than it was 10 or 20 years ago. But
well, yeah, and he was an early huge advocate of the storyboarding, too, yeah.
And he's given up some of that. Into where the camera is, how it moves, and when he cuts, and for what reason. But then you also got, like, Quentin Tarantino, Paul Thomas Anderson, Wes Anderson. These are directors that are sort of in the 40-something range now, I guess. They're real masters of old-school classical filmmaking. And the Coen brothers can always be relied upon for that. Tarantino is probably the coolest of the directors who still knows how to block a shot.
I want to just interject the phone numbers again here. We're talking about summer movies with Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune and Matt Volder's Sites of RogerEbert.com. If you have a movie you want to know more about, or you have a recommendation, something that you think may have been overlooked or this year, 800-222-9455 or 333-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or reach us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. I'm Jeff Bossert. We're going to pause here for a short break. We'll be back with our two film critics to talk about movies. This is Focus. And we're back on Focus. I'm Jeff Bossert talking with film critics Matt Voller's Sites and Michael Phillips about the summer movie season and the year in film so far for 2013. And we'll move on. Maybe we'll talk a bit about comedy, because, Matt, you mentioned that you have a column coming out on Jerks. And I certainly think of, like, comedic films tied to Jerks. I have not seen either one of these. I'm actually not a fan of the Hangover films, but there was Hangover Part 3. And then we have this bizarre film where all these actors are playing themselves, this apocalyptic comedy, This is the End. And I'm wondering if either of those or maybe something similar found its way or is finding its way into this column.
They both do. The author of the piece is Craig Lindsay, who's a really terrific critic out of South Carolina. But yeah, both of those pieces are mentioned. I haven't seen the third Hangover film, and This is the End I'm actually seeing tonight. So I can't, I can only speak in a secondhand way to those movies. Maybe Michael can say more about them in depth. But yeah, definitely Le Cinéma du Jerk, I guess, as the French would say.
In movies like The Hangover Pictures, there's no interesting perspective on the a-holes these guys are. They're just sort of basically meant to be likable, sympathetic a-holes, you know. and that doesn't work in those movies. And I haven't seen the third one either, because I had the terrible misfortune of missing it because I was at the Cannes Film Festival. But you see, you get a movie like, say, in a Noah Baumbach picture like Greenberg, where you have a really interesting and painfully funny portrait of a guy, in that case played by Ben Stiller, who's a misanthrope and just this really sour, a train wreck of a guy, and it's marvelous, you know, and the whole thing is just really has nerve to kind of stick an audience, you know, in that close of proximity with this guy. But it's really on its own terms it works. So, you know, not all jerks are created equal. But
I think I think television, some of the best TV shows have done a much better job recently than American cinema of exploring those kinds of people in a way that is illuminating and often funny. Arrested Development, almost every character on that show is either kind of an emotional basket case or just a jerk. But you're still fascinated because they're funny and they're kind of held at arm's length. Seinfeld used to do that. Curb Your Enthusiasm still does it. And I think Mad Men, a lot of the characters on Mad Men are people that you would not want to know in real life.
No, as you say, Matt, half of the good television doesn't really, that's not paramount in the creators or the writers' minds. How do we keep the audience with us? I mean, they find a way to keep you with them because as you say, there's things like wit and just sort of interesting character development that You know, you can't add wit in on the last polish of a screenplay. You know what I mean? You can't hire a guy to add the wit late.
I got it. No, you can't. And, you know, I actually think, and some of these movies are still hold up pretty well and are fun to watch, but I think that a lot of the comedies and action films of the 80s have a lot to answer for in this regard. When you look back at some of the biggest male stars, they were always guys of the 80s. People like Robin Williams and Eddie Murphy and Bruce Willis and even Bill Murray, who's practically, you know, pretty close to being anointed an American saint right now. But a lot of the characters he played in the 80s were basically jerks. The movies were on their side. Like, you think about how many times the point of the film would be that this really pretty arrogant, horrible person who just runs roughshod over everybody ultimately is proved to be right and exactly the hero that we need.
Or in a case like Groundhog Day, which is probably Murray's best film. You know, I mean, Harold Ramis's best film. You know, it's just the sublimity of the jerkdom of that character as played by Bill Murray. You just can't beat it. But then you get this sort of fascinating comeuppance and also kind of education of the guy. I love Groundhog Day. We were just talking about the other day, but you know, amazing.
There's a sense in which you could say that the second half of Bill Murray's career is, in some ways, an apology for and exploration of the first half.
so we got a couple callers on the line. I wanted to get to. Sorry, guys. Chuck from Champaign is online too. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, this relates back to your earlier talking about people not knowing how to use a static camera, and I filmed that probably very few people ever get to see, but was featured at the Ebert Fest this year, In the Family by Patrick Wang.
Oh, that's a good movie.
Really good film, yeah, really good film.
Yeah, coming out on Blu-ray very soon, by the way.
Sit a camera and use the frame for composition and have all these things going on just at breakfast. And be
yep.
interesting. And then, I mean, what, the last half hour of the movie was a legal deposition?
Yeah. And it's more exciting, in my opinion, than the last hour of the new Superman.
Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing. I really hope he gets a chance to make more movies and get some commercial success, you know, because he certainly, I mean, I think anybody who cares about film would be very impressed with his work if they ever get a chance to see it.
That's a great example.
That was a really good movie. It was a very, very good movie.
Great example. And I think we're also talking about a third option, which is there's a wealth of opportunity in that third option between an intelligently used static camera and, you know, on the high end in terms of quality, really, really kinetic, fast-cutting, kind of nerve-wracking camera work in a good way, the way you get someone like Paul Greengrass in the better of the Bourne pictures. But there's also that third way of just a camera that is, as Matt mentioned, Spielberg still deploys occasionally in movies, some I like Lincoln, some I like less, like War Horse, but he knows how to move a camera gently and sort of slyly around a room or around some sort of exterior setting that just activates the whole scene dramatically without cutting. And that's a strangely satisfying and increasingly lost art.
You know what's really funny, Michael, is you and I both remember this, but in the 80s, guys like Spielberg, George Lucas, Robert Zemeckis, Joe Dante, there were a lot of critics who were much older than us who were complaining that they were destroying movies, that they were junking up movies, that they didn't know how to tell a story, and that there was a kind of a degradation of storytelling evident in their films. But when you look at these guys now, they're like John Ford and Preston Sturges compared to the way movies are made now, which is, you know, not necessarily to wrap every single thing that's being made in the sort of herky jerky style, but it's funny how what was once the devil now seems like, you know, the salvation of cinema.
Right. That's right. That's right.
We've got another caller on the line. Paul has been patiently waiting in Champaign County. Go ahead.
Okay. I don't know what either of your guys' work, and I actually don't remember what Robert Ebert did about documentaries, but it's been a subject at the Academy Awards, and I just think that there's an incredible flowering and blooming and just overwhelmingly vibrant release of documentaries today in San Francisco. Shadows of Liberty, an international documentary on media, et cetera, is being released, but the most recent year of the Academies, there was a whole long list of really pretty intense documentaries, ex-Mossad agents, heads talking, and they picked a good film, Waiting for Sugarman, but it's just kind of ironic that it is actually, in a way, a documentary about the depoliticization of American culture, where this guy who in Detroit who writes these incredibly moving sort of insightful political things and is popular in South Africa, but is just absolutely lost here. And it's just, it seems, it struck me as it's political film in its own way, just kind of chronicling the depoliticization of American culture. And I don't know where you guys are standing on any of this and what how you react, but I just wanted to throw that category in amongst the mixed.
I agree with you. There is, and I find speaking to people who are serious film buffs, who are almost kind of addicted to movies, I don't know very many of them that don't agree with me that nonfiction is consistently more interesting than fiction right now, at least in cinema that's being released in North America.
I think that's true, and I think what we're talking about in some of the sort of the style artifice that a lot of these films are reveling in. You know, they're all that look, the look of Man of Steel, the look of even something like Star Trek or any of these pictures, you know, like World War Z. It's all meant to approximate the look of documentary news cameras running for their lives.
I was going to say running for their lives, that's the ironic thing for me is that when people describe this particular style of action filmmaking as being documentary style, I always kind of laugh because it's like, yeah, if they're either running for their life or if they're a bad documentary filmmaker. Because if you look at like D.A. Pennebaker, the Maisels brothers, Frederick Wiseman, like a lot of the, you know, Barbara Kopple, a lot of the real great classic, monumentally important American documentary filmmakers, they're not swinging the camera around. Like that's like when you yourself have a camcorder and you're taking images of Uncle Carl's 81st birthday. Like that kind of camera work is what you see in J.J. Abrams. It's not what Albert Maisels would do, where he's rock steady. He's holding, you know, he's an 80-year-old man holding the camera on his shoulder. He still shoots stuff. And you would think it was on a tripod, it's so steady. Mm. I'm sorry to keep harping on this, but I just feel like it's somehow indicative of the hype that makes so many modern movies kind of unbearable.
Well, sometimes a movie doesn't have to have any visual distinction to work. You haven't seen it yet, Matt, but This Is the End, which is a movie that shouldn't work at all. It's objectively speaking, it's coarser than any of the Hangovers, but you know, all three of them put together probably. The rest of it, this is, you know, Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg's apocalyptic sort of self-referential lark that, you know, we have Seth Rogen and Jay Baruchel and Jonah Hill, everybody playing themselves as these insecure, narcissistic L.A. comedians trying to deal with the apocalypse. That movie has so many laughs in it. It's not, believe me, it's not for everybody. And the crowd I saw it with was like an illustration of its likely fate, which is half the crowd really loving it, a third of them drifting or running out, in fact, in suburban Chicago, running in the car. And but that film actually knows how to set up and film and execute a gag, hit it hard, fast, and move on, boom. And that's what I don't get from the Hangover pictures. I get a kind of a lingering, heavy-spirited, you know, emphasis on physical pain and violence. And to me, those don't even play like comedies. They don't play like slapstick comedies. They play like action movies that are called comedies, but, and they're big hits, so who am I to argue with the public?
Well,
I am the guy to argue with the public.
We got a couple other callers.
Go ahead. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Mary in Urbana is on line three, or line two. Go ahead, Mary.
Yes, hi. I have a recommendation for an underappreciated film for perhaps next year's festival, Crimes of the Heart.
Yes, absolutely.
God, I haven't seen that for a long time. Bruce Beresford's film version of the Beth Henley comedy.
Exactly. The Pulitzer Prize-winning play, actually. And, I mean, look at the cast. It was Jessica Lange and Diane Keaton and Sissy Spacek. I mean, what more can you ask for? But
no,
you never
not
hear
a whole
about
lot.
It. Like one of my lifetime favorite movies. because it has parts that make you just laugh out loud over some really uncomfortable matters that everybody's not going to be laughing out loud over generally. But it's a wonderful movie. I just never hear anything about it from anybody. And I wondered if you can recommend any movies along that line that I could watch, because I'm not into the shoot 'em ups and the blow 'em ups and the apocalypse and all that, but some other just kind of gentle, really biting humor type of things, like Crimes of the Heart.
Have you seen Junebug?
Oh, Junebug is great.
You know, Roger showed that. I know Roger showed that down at Ebertfest several years ago. But if you have not seen Junebug, I suspect you're really going to go for that.
I just recommended that movie to my girlfriend last week, Junebug. Oh. That's a movie that I recommend a lot. It's really something.
And you're still going out, Matt? You're still going out?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So it worked.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, and Amy Adams before she was a Hollywood star.
That's right. I think that comes to mind for that sort of thing. You know, it's also of the same, relatively the same vintage as Crimes of the Heart. But if you haven't seen Moonstruck in a while, Norman Jewison's film,
I did
rewatch
that, and you're right. And the second
snap
time,
out of it.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful script by John Patrick Shanley that actually feels like a filmed play, but it was written for the screen. But Shanley's a playwright, Pulitzer Prize winner for the play Doubt. And that's got a lot of the same. It's you know, dark comedy, but it's serious about the romances.
Like, watching it the second time was like I'd never watched it the first time, because the second time you just, there's so much more. You catch the nuances and stuff that I guess went right by in the first time, but and you know, Cher is just ridiculously good in that show.
She's good. It's the one time she was really well. She's been pretty good in other things, but she's the whole cast is. I mean, John Mahoney. Everybody. I mean, Olympia Dukakis has never been better. So there's your weekend right there, Junebug and Moonstruck and a little popcorn.
Hey, Mary, have you seen Once Around?
Who's in it?
Yeah, Holly Hunter and Richard Dreyfuss and Danny Aiello. And
yes.
Lord, that's one that I think has been largely forgotten, which is unfortunate because I think it's kind of perfect.
Matt,
I disagree with you. I'm sorry.
I
found that movie really pushy and kind of
cool. What were you saying, Mary? Sorry?
But what about another Beth Henley, that Miss Firecracker?
Oh, that's a really good one, too.
I like that one. Yeah, I like that one.
Performance by Tim Robbins. Well, really by everyone in that movie, yet it all works somehow.
Right, yeah. So those are the movies that, I'm sure there's not a huge mass appeal for those. But it would be nice to have a movie here or there that is that genre, you know. I have no interest whatsoever in Batman or Dick Tracy or whoever else they've got out there.
Hey, I have another one you might check out that Roger showed a couple, 3 years ago that I really like, from Richard Linklater, Me and Orson Welles. Have you seen that film?
Yes, I have. That is a great one, too.
Good. Glad you liked it.
I don't know who that writer was of that, but I don't know how that person came up with that whole concept. That is a wonderful movie.
Yeah, good. Good. All right,
Mary, I want to thank you for the call. We've got somebody else waiting. Rose is in Urbana on line 3. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning. We just saw the movie called Before Midnight, and I had seen the previous two in the trilogy, and it got so many good reviews, this most recent one, and I just thought it was terrible. And I was wondering what you thought of it. I just thought it was incredibly indulgent and not good at all.
Well, I did think it was a step down from the first two, although I was happy to make the investment to revisit it because I really did think those first two were special, and I guess, you know, maybe deliberately, maybe not. The way I kind of read the movie that in that they were pushing those two characters so close to the breaking point in asking the question, should they be together, that they risked kind of throwing your sympathy or empathy right out the window. And I find that especially with Ethan Hawke in those movies, who's frankly, you know, he'll never be better on screen as an actor, but he's never half as good as Julie Delpy is in any moment. That's how I feel about it. I just feel like he's
always showboating. It is pretty amazing, though, when you look at the totality of what Richard Linklater and Delpy and Hawke are doing. It's impressive. I mean, the idea of following this couple over time, and I think more than one critic has compared it to Michael Apted's series of Up documentaries, and there is something to that, I think.
Yeah, this movie is sour, didn't you think? I mean, it's a sour film, whether you liked it or not. It's definitely harsher and more sour than the previous two.
I think it was, but it just, I didn't care about the characters. It just seemed they didn't make me want to kind of get more involved in their difficulties. I don't know. Maybe it's just a personal taste, but the scene of the family sitting around the table, and then especially the very long shot of them walking away from some kind of castle. I'm not sure what it was, but there was a long scene of them having a discussion. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just thought, why is this so good?
The one thing, it did get me interested in pursuing one of those writing fellowships that he's on and enjoying in Greece.
That might be the most redeeming feature.
Thanks, Russ, for the call. I'm sorry, we need to move on. We just got a couple of minutes here left. We got one more caller left, but I wanted to ask Michael really quick. You wanted to bring up Much Ado About Nothing, and this is the Shakespeare interpretation by Joss Whedon, who's best known for the last summer's The Avengers.
I'm glad you brought that up. It's one of the real surprises this summer, and you have to hunt for it, I think. But Whedon shot this movie in 12 days in his house with a lot of the actors from his various TV shows and films, and it's sort of a straightforwardly contemporary setting of Shakespeare's romantic comedy. It's the greatest romantic comedy ever written in any medium. B, even with the very kind of defiantly American-sounding poetry you're hearing, you know, this is not Shakespeare on screen with any kind of rhetorical flourish. But that movie really works. It completely invests in the situations, and I just find that these days, when you're just dying for romantic comedies that don't stink and don't completely malign or marginalize the female characters, it's just wonderful to see. You know, a variously talented cast. You know, some better than others, but just dealing with the great material, intelligently updated. I totally went for it.
I haven't seen it yet, but I see pretty much every adaptation of Shakespeare that makes its way onto a screen. So I'm surely going to see it soon. Although you're mentioning that it was shot in his house, did you see the version of Hamlet that Campbell Scott did about 10 or 12 years ago?
Yeah, it's good.
It's also really, it is really good, and it also has that sort of weird sense of intimacy that comes from just shooting in some guy's house in modern dress.
We've just a couple of minutes left, so I'm going to ask Marjorie and Muhammad to be brief with their question. Go ahead, line two.
Okay, I guess I'm not going to have as much a chance as I was thinking about it. I'm going to be the great-grandmother of this group. I mentioned a picture that I saw recently, Lonely Are the Brave. Isn't that a wonderful movie? I mean, it's got Kirk Douglas at his best. It's got Jenna Rollins, although she doesn't have a big part. And the excitement and the human drama. And I just was really happy to have seen it a second time.
There are a lot of those end of the West Westerns that were being made in the 60s, and I think that's one of the best of them, actually. It's really, really good. And the final, I won't give it away for people who haven't seen it, but the final sequence in that movie is quite something.
It's got and that cast, it just keeps going. It's got everybody from Walter Matthau to Carol O'Connor to, you know, George Kennedy. Bill Bixby's in it. I mean, it's great. It's great supporting actor watching.
Well, we've got to wrap this up. Any couple titles you guys are looking forward to more late this year?
I mean, Anchorman 2, I got to follow my son's tastes. You know, I'm the same kind of highbrow sophisticate he is. And
yeah, actually, I am looking forward to that, although I'm looking ahead more to the fall and particularly to Wolf of Wall Street, which looks like Scorsese being fun, which he hasn't been fun a whole lot in recent decades. And every time he is, I really enjoy myself.
Let's hope they're both terrific in their own ways.
Well, I want to thank all the callers. We had several this hour, and we want to thank Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune and Matt Voller's sites of Chicago, or rather, RogerEbert.com. Hope to have you both on later this year. We can talk more about the fall and Oscar movie season.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft was at the controls. We'd love additional comments or thoughts you have about today's show at our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Tomorrow on the program, Jim Meadows is back at the host chair to talk about wine. He'll be joined by Bradley Beam with the Illinois Grape Growers and Vintners Association. I'm Jeff Bossert. This is Focus.